and gentlemen. As I stated at the outset, we're going to take case number 14 out of order. Once again, we have a new face on this panel, and it's Justice Rick Beals, who's seated on my left.
Definitely.
And you guys are ready to go. I like that. So.
Good afternoon. Ronald Richards, R-I-C-H-A-R-D-S, for the appellant, and I'll reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal. First of all, I want to thank this court for always being a leader in the state for giving tentative opinions. It makes it much easier for counsel to get right and focused. I'm not going to argue against pages 1 through 14 because it's been, 30 years since this issue was properly addressed. But I do want to point out something to the court on page 15 of the tentative, simply related to our two forbearance agreements. Just as a reminder, there was moving declarations and opposing declarations. And in this particular case, at page, volume 3 of 3 at page 522, specifically at page 525, paragraphs 17 and 18, we did lay the foundation through Mr. Koenigsaker's declaration for the admissibility of the forbearance agreement. Objection 5 was overruled in its entirety, and that court's ruling is on page 708 of the record. And so they were exhibits G and H of the appendix. And then objection 6 merely objected to the testimony or the opining of Mr. Koenigsaker, not the actual exhibit, and exhibit H was admitted. So I would just ask the court, if it wouldn't mind, assuming that's accurate, giving us a ruling on the forbearance agreements, because they weren't excluded and they weren't addressed by the trial court, but they were in fact admitted. There's plenty of times where a respondent did make objections in the record where they objected to specific exhibits, like the entire exhibit. So this is not a misreading of the objection. The objection on paragraph 17 specifically actually states on this is at 525 of the record, lines 4 through 7, after the objection where they objected to his editorializing, there was the sentence, or actually in paragraph 18 as well, lines 12 through 14, a true and correct copy of forbearance agreement number 2 is attached as exhibit H, and then on line 5, which was overruled, so it was admitted anyway, a true and correct copy of forbearance agreement number 1 is attached as exhibit G. So there was no authentication issue. That's my only point. He just didn't address it because really the gist of that oral argument was the issue that you addressed in pages 1 through 14 of your tentative in dealing with the Simons case and the Roseleaf case and all sorts of other issues. So if you don't have any questions about pages 1 through 14, I'm going to hold my time. I pointed out my view on the forbearance agreements, which I think should be upheld. Those are common when a borrower refinances, and if you wouldn't mind, I'd like it addressed at some point.
We flagged this as considering publication, at least as to part one. That's the really significant holding in this case, and is of some statewide significance, I would assume. You would be in agreement with that?
100%, because a lot of times, as you could probably imagine, unless you want to really invest the time and the money, when you see trends in the law, some stuff gets unpublished, people settle cases. We felt that it was time to finally deal with the Simons issue and have a court actually apply Roseleaf and apply it correctly and realize that the anti-deficiency statute is limited to a deed, not deeds, and it limits just one deed. Your tentative was a true expression of our position, so there's nothing, I don't need to repassionate it, but the case should be published because it's an important issue, and people that borrow money shouldn't get a windfall on a different deed of trust if it's sold out. And the corrective application of the statute should be used statewide.
Thanks, Mr. Richards. And we'll hear from a respondent.
Good
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Eric Schiffer on behalf of the respondents, S-C-H-I-F-F-E-R, from Schiffer and Boos. Your Honors, I certainly appreciate, I'll echo counsel's sentiment, the tentative opinion that was published. It certainly helps us focus. Unfortunately, my client finds himself on the wrong side of it. But
either way, it helps you.
It absolutely does.
You know what the thinking is up front rather than thinking of an argument.
And I do appreciate that.
As you're driving home.
And I think it's very helpful to practitioners.
Okay.
So let me get into it. Having said all of that, let me get into why I think perhaps the panel might consider reconsidering its okay. position. At page 9 of the decision, the court posits whether or not Roseleaf should have been contorted as it was, as the court puts it, to say that 580D applies if the same lender owns the senior and the junior lien interest. And my response to that would be, Roseleaf, if you read the case itself, what's at work in Roseleaf is the premise of protecting the junior lienor against a selling senior lienor, a selling senior lienor. And what that means is that, what the language that we see in there is that the whim of the senior shouldn't be dictating what happens to a junior lien. It shouldn't prejudice it. That was the premise of Roseleaf, and that was under the context of the 580D anti-deficiency statute. Roseleaf involved different loans, not only different loans, different properties securing the loans. The factual context of Roseleaf, the premise of a junior being at the whim of a senior, having no control over what the senior does, was a moment in Roseleaf's time. That was what the factual background was for that case. But law evolves. And 30 years later, the Simon Court up in the First District was presented with a situation where, gee, you have a unity of interest. You've got a single lender that owns both the senior and the junior lien. How do you reconcile that with Roseleaf? Roseleaf says, well, the junior shouldn't be at the whim of the senior, but the senior is the junior. They're the same entity. So Simon's conclusion in that instance was that it's not really a sold-out third-party junior because they made the choice to make themselves a junior. Now, Simon, you know, looked at instances where there may have been reasons afoot to try to trick or to have some artifice, but it also said even if there are legitimate reasons, you can't take the position of making yourself into a sold-out junior and then say, hey, I'm a sold-out junior. That was what it was struggling with. And its position,
if I may.
Yes.
And look, you're exactly correct. Simon did say that this was not proper. But in Simon's, wasn't Simon's concern with the fact that you might have some type of trickery afoot, right? So in order to avoid the anti-deficiency statutes, you just stack a whole bunch of loans at one time. In this case, you have one loan now, and a couple of years later, you have another loan. Does that mean your clients will not be able to go back to the same lender and say, legitimately, we need this money? Right?
Not at all, Your Honor. And in fact, to get back to Simon, Simon said, you know, there may or may not be trickery, but it also said, if you read Simon, that irrespective of whether there was trickery, you can't have a scenario where you're choosing to eliminate yourself, thereby calling yourself a sold-out junior, and then saying, well, I get to enjoy all the, I get to get around 580D in that scenario.
Does that prejudice your client who then seeks to get a legitimate loan a couple of years down the line? They say, no, we can't do that?
Well, it wouldn't prejudice our client. If we look at the case at hand, we've got two loans that are now owned by the same lender, and it's almost, well, it's not exactly what it was in Simon, but it's a similar premise. But the issue is, can the same lender who bought these two loans at the same time, now, you know, we're talking about when one loan was made and when another loan was made, but the reality was Black Sky bought the loans at the same time for an undisclosed amount, and we're assuming to be well under what the market value of the loans probably were, and then chose to non-judicially foreclose on the first, thereby taking away the right of redemption from the borrowers. They could have judicially foreclosed. They grouse in their briefing how it would be so onerous to make them do that. But by choosing to non-judicially foreclose, they're taking an option away from my clients. If someone defaults on their loan, they're not to be punished for it. There are remedies built into the law, right? So they're sort of taking this position that, well, they're in default, so you should be punished. There's nothing you can say about it. And that shouldn't be the case. They chose, they took all of the actions they chose to take in this case. They bought both of these loans. They non-judicially foreclosed on the first. By operation of Simon, that wiped out the first and the second, and it took away their right to seek a deficiency under the second. And my point on how Simon interacts with Roseleaf, it's an evolution. I mean, this court looked at Simon as though it had created what the court is saying is an equitable exception to 580D. And I would say that it's not an equitable exception. It's an evolution because facts change. The way lending practices are done has changed.
Well, I have a question about that. It seems like it may be an exception because the statute itself doesn't refer to multiple notes, only refers to that particular note. And looking at the statute, it says no deficiency shall be owed or collected, and no deficiency judgment shall be rendered for deficiency on a note. It doesn't say a second or some other note, on a note secured by a deed of trust or mortgage on real property, et cetera, et cetera.
That's correct, Your Honor. And your concern in the opinion at page 13 is that somehow Simon is inserting language into the statute that is not meant to be there, and that was Cable Rock's concern as well. But I would say this to that point, Your Honor. If we look at what the Supreme Court recently did in the Coker versus J.P. Morgan case, that was a 2016 decision, 62 Cal 4th, 667. It was referenced in appellant's opening brief at page 35. In the Coker case, the court looked at a different section of the anti-deficiency statutes. It looked at the 580B, which deals with protecting purchase money against a deficiency in the instance of foreclosure. In that case, the court specifically addressed the issue at page 674, whether to expand 580B beyond foreclosure to also include short sales. Short sales were not written into that statute. But the court did the same thing the court in Simon did. It looked at the wealth of the case law, and the court specifically in Coker said, you've got to focus on the substance and not the form of the loan. And in doing so, it didn't rewrite the statute. It didn't add those words short sale. It said, you know, the statute says what it says, but looking at our history here and looking at how we do things, and most importantly, looking at the liberal application that's supposed to be given to the anti-deficiency statutes, which almost all the courts are unanimous, which this very court was acknowledged in the opinion, doing that, it's appropriate to then say, we are going to expand it. Now, that's not an exception. I mean, I believe that's a way to evolve the law to reflect modern lending practices. The short sale wasn't part of the statute when it was written, so the court looked at it to see whether or not an expansion in that direction made sense. That's similar to what happened in Simon. Roseleaf was not presented with a situation where you had a unity of ownership of loans. Simon was. Simon said in that instance, there is no whim of a senior that Roseleaf was so concerned about. That doesn't exist here. What does exist is someone making themselves a sold-out junior, which Simon found to not really be a bona fide sold-out junior, and that was the premise for the position in Simon. And many courts have followed Simon. Simon was in 92, so you've got 25 years of the second district following it in the Mitchell case. You've got the fifth district following it. It wasn't until 2012 when the fourth district, Division III, your sister court, in dictum said, you know, we have this issue. It's kind of close here. It's a little bit different than our case here because the Cattle Rock case actually did have a different lender for the senior and the junior, so it didn't really need to go beyond that analysis. But it said, you know, we could stop here, but we're not going to. We think that the Simon decision is wrong. It was very critical of the Simon decision, and this court has largely echoed Cattle Rock's criticism of Simon. And that was the first time when this mechanism has been questioned after 25 years of jurisprudence that has accepted the Simon premise. Miller and Starr has accepted the Simon premise. All the treatises seem to agree. So now here we are. And I bring up the Coker case because I think that represents a good idea of how these cases need to evolve to embrace new lending concepts, that you can't be static to what Roseleaf said in 1963 on a specific scenario where the very premise of the case was to protect a junior from the whim of the senior. We're not there anymore. We've got multiple financing layers. We've got piggyback financing, we've got kangaroo financing, whatever you want to call it, that's not where we are anymore, and things have to evolve. And in 50 years, I think, you know, the Supreme Court has not revisited the 580D issue from Roseleaf. Perhaps it's time to, and perhaps if the court is inclined to keep its tentative opinion in pages 1 to 14, I would urge the court to publish the opinion because I think this is something that perhaps the California Supreme Court might be interested in looking at. I mean, I don't know. I don't think they like their districts disagreeing with one another. So I would say that if the court is inclined to uphold the tentative, that it does indeed consider publishing. We believe the judgment, granting summary judgment, was proper. We believe that judgment should have been affirmed. Just to address briefly, if I can, in my closing moments, what counsel raised on the forbearance agreement issues, there were a variety of objections, and I know the court didn't really get to them because, based upon the ruling, didn't really need to get to them. But if the court is going to get to them, we would submit that they waived those arguments. Nowhere in their opening brief did they ever complain about the objections. I raised that in our respondent's brief, that they waived that right to raise it now. So I believe that those were not properly preserved because they weren't briefed in the appeal. Just because they were in the record doesn't mean that they've been preserved.
Right.
So with that, unless the court has other questions for me, I would submit.
I guess we're good for right now. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
And
final
remarks, Mr. Richards.
Thank you.
First, the reason why we didn't address the objections is because there was no objections to the forbearance agreement because the court admitted them in paragraph 17 and 18. So we didn't have an issue with him limiting the editorial. Getting to the comments about the policy, first of all, this prophylactic rule would hurt borrowers from coming back to the bank. And it would also cause a fictitious flipping where you would, like, have your own single-purpose entity and right before the sale you'd give it to your other entity. And it would encourage shenanigans for no reason. The Mitchell case and all the cases counsel cited that were wrongly following Simons, those are piggyback financing cases. And as you pointed out, there's no evidence here. 5 years went by. This was a refi. There was no purchase money. Counsel was citing to you the Coker case. That's a 580B case, no applicability, and that's a purchase money. Big difference. This is a sophisticated borrower that's borrowing $10 million, and now basically because the lender took an inexpensive route to foreclose on the first deed of trust, he wants a $2 million windfall to keep the money. It's not like the money didn't go to respondent. He got the money. So the Simons case was always poorly decided, but it was always cabined by the facts of piggyback financing. So that's why this case had percolated, because, again, not a lot of people want to spend the time and money to push it through and get to these positions. There's no requirement to go to judicial foreclosure. There's a lot of prejudice to borrowers for doing that, and counsel, you know, respectfully cited Miller and Starr. I mean, that's not the court of appeal. If I would win cases by citing a treatise, I'd be a very successful lawyer because you could always find a treatise to take a position. But Miller and Starr just has a general position. You could find all sorts of debates on this issue in briefs throughout the state. This is not an issue that people don't discuss. It's possible the Supreme Court may look at it, but they also may follow their own precedent and say it's not necessary, because what counsel's really saying is he wants you to augment or graft on additional language to the anti-deficiency statute, which, as you pointed out, is not the obligation of a court. We did shamelessly borrow a little bit of dicta from Cattle Rock. I mean, when we saw the opinion and the dicta, we were more enthusiastic about bringing the case forward. And counsel's right; it was dicta. But this case had the correct factual predicate. There was no sinister plot to defraud the borrower. There was no taking advantage of this borrower. This is a big office building in Ontario. The borrower has a lot of assets. He wanted a bunch of money from the bank. He got it. Then he wanted more money. He got it. And then he didn't want to pay. These small banks get in trouble, and then they have to sell the loans to a secondary credit market so they have liquidity for their borrowers. It's the taxpayers that end up paying for these defaults. So the issue really is it unfair, or there's something wrong where you would want to graft a prophylactic rule? And I would submit to you, no. There's no public policy reason. He's only hurting the secondary credit market, and a bank would be afraid to give a refi if they thought somehow that would be subject them to an expensive judicial foreclosure process or something else. And because this case was so obscure and it was from 1992, I would also tell you that generally counsel, if they just looked, opened the book and said, hey, I want to do a foreclosure, and they read the statute in the plain meaning, they would never think about the Simons risk, because most of the time the junior lien holder the general rule is the junior lien holder, the fact that they're sold out has no bearing on whether they could then sue on an unsecured claim on the promissory note. This case isn't a red flasher in every single treatise. And it's just so happened that in this particular case, I'll also tell you, there's opinions out there, you know, where they argue even if you do assign it to another entity, well, it could have been the same equity. I mean, it creates collateral litigation when the statute is plain and clear. So unless the panel has specific questions, I think that you're circumscribing this to the single note is the correct analysis, and the fact that it was wrong for so many years doesn't mean we shouldn't make it right and follow under auto equity the Roseleaf opinion. Roseleaf doesn't have exceptions to it. It's very clearly written, and it's cited in many treatises. So if the panel has any comments or policy questions, I would be happy to address them.
No questions, just a comment. I think we've had the benefit of good advocacy on both sides.
Thank you.
And I sincerely appreciate the efforts.
We did think both sides' briefing was very well thorough.
Well, and the advocacy was good. And I think we have not seen that. If we go into print, we obviously probably are. We'll discuss it. I don't think it'll stay in print very long. Thank you, gentlemen. And a safe trip.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen.